So here are some comments on a portion of a recent book called Joyful Militancy by Nick Montgomery and Carla Bergman from 2017. So this is pretty contemporary. It's saying a whole lot of things that you should be relatively familiar with now, but it's adding in one or two details that I definitely want to touch on. And I also wanted to sort of drive home the position that I've been offering, which is that these traditions we've looked at through this class, beginning with Aristotle and a certain materialist tradition in the West, but then sort of moving over to indigenous thought and Black liberation thought and specifically anarchist thought. All of these things sort of end up in a contemporary hybrid, which is one that I find very persuasive and that I know a lot of other intellectuals and activists find persuasive. I know a lot of people who think along the lines that are offered in the texts that we're looking at in these last few segments. So the thing that is primarily new in this particular text, from our perspective, that we have not yet looked at very thoroughly, is the contributions of Spinoza and the ideas of ethics versus morals and the specific recommendations about relationship building and the building of power that are really coming out of Spinoza. They're in a lot of the other people that I've given you to read, but I didn't give you sections that really focused on them. So these are contemporary anarchist theorists and activists. At least one of them also is like a filmmaker. And they're doing a synthetic work, sort of in the way that Taiyake synthesized some views from within his community by building a text that involved a whole lot of quotation. They're doing a similar thing with figures they consider to be important. And if you want to get a sense of who are the important references for a certain, I don't know, abolitionist, feminist, anti-capitalist vision, which a lot of people operate on the basis of today, the Monty and Bergman text is a good place to, you know, start your reading list. You know, the people that they reference are people that a lot of us care about. You know, this includes, of course, the Invisible Committee and Tikkun, which we've talked about, but also Moton and Harney, who we've looked at as kind of contemporary Black liberation thinkers, Tai Ayake and then Glenn Coulthard as indigenous thinkers, Sylvia Federici and the post-autonomous feminists, Vandana Shiva and Maria Meese as kind of feminist anti-globalist thinkers. Anyway, we're looking at a synopsis of late 20th and early 21st century theorists who are really depended on today in order for a lot of people to think about what should we do? How should we organize ourselves? What do we need to put our energy into if we want to reverse a machinery which, you know, as Taiyake said, a whole lot of us can very easily see is destroying the planet and therefore destroying human life and taking out a whole lot of species with it. And do we really want to pass this cancer on to our children and our children's children? Or do we want to take steps such that at least we did what we could at the last hour? So what is that thing that we should do at the last hour? Okay, let's review some familiar things, which may be in somewhat different language here, about relationships. The concern of this text is about relationships. Joyful militancy is about the building, the careful building, the intentional building of not just any old relationships, but good ones, and the building of relationships into relational webs, which are prefigurative. And we haven't really talked about prefigurative politics, except that we have in a whole bunch of ways without using that term. Prefigurative politics means that we want to establish as a present situation, in whatever degree and manner possible, the goal that we are aiming at in a longer term time frame. Prefiguration means like let's put here now what we want here later to the best of our ability. Prefigurative politics. So here's an analysis that should be relatively familiar in a language that should be somewhat familiar. They use the language of empire, which we saw first in Tikkun, but which is probably formalized really in Negri and Hart as a term for the general overall functioning, especially as it relates to ethical, political tissue, everyday life, and the norms and roles and feelings that compose it on a global scale. That's empire. It works by breaking us into parts, right, for one thing. This was called hostility. Hostility was a primary ethical behavior or attribute of empire. In the Tikkun text, these people are referring to Tikkun and the Invisible Committee on multiple occasions, as does the Black liberation thinker Fred Moten, remember. Anyway, a key aspect of our contemporary situation and also of the way that we are kept weakened, and therefore that situation is kept in place such that it can continue to extract energy to produce goods, to extract labor, to distribute goods, to collect profit, to repeat until the whole earth is nothing but a bunch of toxic holes and we are a bunch of shells with no relationships left. A key way in which empire operates is by atomizing relationships, breaking us apart from one another. So even the models of freedom that most of us have when we show up to a course like this where we're going to think about freedom are already models of freedom that are broken, that are weakened, that are therefore fundamentally unfree because they are always individualistic models of freedom. So the claim here is that any society that has been broken into individuals who feel that they really have no guides but their own self-interest and maybe some sort of abstract monopoly, and that even if they do have connections with others, those connections are very limited. They're limited to nuclear families. They're limited to professional relationships. And so even the relationships that guide my life are really a part of the overall hierarchical machinery which carries out this capitalist state performance. We are broken apart, and a society where that is the case is barely a society at all, and is barely a society that does not have the capacity to push back against this overall global organization which is killing us and which has genocided the beautiful societies that barely still exist and perhaps from which we could still learn. So the claim is that this atomization, here they focus on two levels. There's the atomization to the individual, and then there's the breakdown of family ties, kinship networks, into small, self-contained, little suburban bubbles, mommy, daddy, me. That's a Deleuze and Guattari phrase. Mommy, daddy, me, the Oedipal triangle, the nuclear family, with all of its neuroses and its repression and its inhibition of sexuality and its patriarchal repetitions and so forth. So we are locked inside ourselves, and we are taught, we are trained, we are interpolated as beings who waver between self-interest and morality. I know that I'm supposed to act so as to advance my position in this society. I know that I'm supposed to act so as to increase my power and my wealth as an individual in the society, which basically just means giving the structures what they want and moving up within the given structures. So everything that I am supposed to understand about my well-being, about becoming better, becoming stronger, transforming myself in this society is really about augmenting and advancing the function of the overall system. It's not society, it's empire. I throw myself into empire, hoping that it will give me myself back, but it only ever gives me back a sad and separated me who is different from the member of a robust society with all kinds of relationships and connections that would make me up in a situation somewhat outside of this. And of course, we do supplement these things. We are not every one of us atomized to the last possible degree, because it's not only empire that's going on. It's also, as we'll see with Uchulan, there's also democracy. There's a democratic civilization that always accompanies the onslaughts of empire. But we're supposed to forget about that. And then on the other hand, perhaps we are motivated by notions of morality. That is, things that we are duty-bound to do because of our total nature, because of metaphysical realities, because of biblical prescriptions and the like. And we waver between these things, and some of us lean towards self-interest and some of us lean towards morality, but this morality is still individualistic. And, you know, in its history, in its genealogy, has everything to do with the salvation of my soul and the fear of a big daddy in the sky that is going to punish me if I do wrong. There are friends in this atomized imperial circumstance, but the friends are thin too. My friends, at the worst in the sense of empire, and probably this is most of our friends, there are people who I relate to passively because we share, as Tikkun would put it, predicates. There are things about me that are also things about you that fit together. Okay, I like to play Grand Theft Auto and so do you, right? We have a similarity, but the similarity has no potentiality to transform us. Our friendships are largely about, just not being alone, about maintaining one another's comfort in our aloneness, about finding similarity which will reinforce the predicates, the aspects of this identity that we have been given and are always re-given by these advertising and capitalist and statist networks. Most of our friendships do not involve a risk. There's not a risk that I will become through my friendships with most of my friends in this empire, that I will become through that relationship something other than I already am. But as the Invisible Committee says, never forget the political dimension of friendship. If you're going to hold on to those connections, if you're going to commit, if you're going to take a risk with your friend or your lover, and maybe, you know, love and friendship are kind of a continuum. If we're going to make those things real, if we're going to strengthen them, we're going to be doing something against what empire wants. We're going to be identifying and growing the intensities, the potentialities that exist within these relationships. And this is going to require political commitment, ethical commitment. We have to defend these relationships. We have to intentionally nurture them. We have to make sacrifices of our time and our comfort in order to pursue these friendships. But generally, this is not what people do. They just have one friend in one place because they both like to go to the symphony. They both like to go out to certain shows or certain clubs, and they move to another town, and they'll just find some other people which satisfy this aspect of their comfort. You know, I just had a flashback of, you know, Ed Norton at the beginning of Fight Club, whose entire identity is built around the different items he purchases from IKEA, right? Our friends seem to fit into this network of purchases which build out our identity and sustain our comfort as we live in tiny little sad bubbles, right? And thus the rest of the movie. There's a whole lot of energy and a whole lot of passion and a whole lot of force that is subdued and, I don't know, what's the word, narcotized, you know, made numb, such that that energy can be extracted entirely for work and for capital valorization. That's empire. And then at the level of family, we are encouraged to have kinship ties, which go together with certain forms of moral obligation. But these family situations are themselves sick and neurotic and broken, because they're basically broken down to the parents and one or a few children who live in a self-contained place. And yes, it's true that a whole lot of people in our city, their kinship networks go further than this. This is a way in which a democratic and relational kinship network that is desirable from this, I don't know, what is it, a narco-indigenous perspective. Those networks exist, that strength exists. Society, to some degree, still exists. But the longer you live here, the more it will be destroyed. We are encouraged to think of family as nothing but the nuclear family, and yet it may be necessary to push beyond that. So this is the analysis. It's a familiar analysis. And the recommendations in return have to do with resurgence in the Ty Iacke and Glenn Coulthard sense. We need to build, but resurgence not just as the replacement of existing problematic non-relations with old forms of relation. Rather, we have to operate given the situations in which we really find ourselves in order to build new kinship networks. And one of the models that they reference several times are kind of queer intentional families, where one experience of the queer community is to be kicked out of nuclear families. This is a harsh and unforgiving aspect of heteronormativity, but maybe it also constitutes and has constituted a real potentiality for growing other forms of society. So people who find one another, who have been kicked out by the social settings into which they were born, find one another and make commitments to one another, treat one another with care and responsibility beyond just enjoying one another or making one another comfortable, but support one another, take the place of brothers and sisters and mothers and fathers who didn't want you. These different forms of family, different forms of kin, making people into family, even though the books, the records, the birth certificates don't say that they're family. This is one of the key tactics that is recommended here. And the overall analysis that they're recommending is that we got to think a whole lot about friendship and the way that friendship and freedom fit together. Those terms, they say, have the same root. Okay, so let's shift over to Spinoza. There's a lot of Spinoza here, and in a lot of the people that we've looked at, in Tikkun, there's Spinoza all over the place. I didn't really talk about it because I knew that I would have a chance now. Spinoza through Nietzsche, in some ways, Spinoza leads into Marx, but by way of Hegel. So Spinoza through Nietzsche and Deleuze and Guattari and Foucault, let's say, has a lot of influence over late 20th century and early 21st century proto or neo-anarchist thought. Spinoza's my favorite Western philosopher. There are a couple things I could criticize about him, but generally I think he's right. I just didn't include him because I include him in one or two of my other classes and because he's very difficult to read, writing in the towards the end of the 1600s. And in this geometrical fashion, which is very strange and opaque to a whole lot of people. But in a lot of ways, I think he's right. He's so useful. And he's part of a materialist tradition, which, we have already seen in this class, that leads all the way back to Aristotle. A lot of Aristotle in Spinoza. But there's something more pushy, too. Spinoza was banished from his Jewish community in his day. He was born Baruch Spinoza, and he died Benedictus de Spinoza. He shifted to the Latin term. He was kicked out of the Hebrew community for attacking standard models of morality and the notion of individual freedom, among other things. He doesn't believe in individual freedom. It's an illusion produced by ignorance. We think that we are free because we see the effects of our, we see ourselves act, but we do not perceive the causes of how we act. And yet, of course, he would say those causes do exist. Anyway, so Spinoza is a heretic. He's literally a heretic. And he's a materialist heretic, although he's also sometimes referred to as a God-intoxicated man. He's also a mystic. Super cool. So here's some stuff about Spinoza that they would like you to think about in terms of what should we do, how is it related to ethics and relationships and friendship and freedom. First of all, most of Western philosophy concerns itself with answering questions about what are certain things. What are we? What is a man? What is a woman? And what are their duties? These are very Kantian ways of talking. Like in Deleuze's philosophy, Kant is like the enemy. Deleuze wrote, a dozen books about different philosophers. And Kant, he says, I wrote this book as about an enemy. So that Kantian idea that there are universal things, that we just have a subjective structure, that's not at all what Spinoza is interested in. Let's not look at what we are. Let's not look for abstract philosophical definitions of ourselves that can be applied generally in too many cases. Let's look at what we do. Like, as in tikkun, let's reduce things to practices. Let's be heretics and refuse to believe in things that we can't say. And instead, what we'll say is that everything I can see is a practice, and we need to focus on those practices, and we got to ask which ones are we a part of, and we got to ask which ones are good for us, and how do we nurture them, or how do we transform them? How do we nurture the good ones? How do we transform or cut off the bad ones? How do we alter practices in a way that is desirable? And this desirable means in a way that makes us more free, which is in Spinoza the same thing as, this is not individual freedom, it's participation in the larger network of causes. The broader my participation in the network of causes, the freer I am, the more powerful I am. That means the more we combine together, the more powerful we are and the freer we are. So let's not think about human nature. Let's not think about human duty. And let's not focus either, like when it comes time to think about how we relate to the situation around us and how we relate more specifically to the individuals around us, let's not start with what we say. Let's focus instead on what we do. Instead of trying to form alliances on the basis of shared ideology, I believe this, you believe the same thing, and therefore we are friends. Instead, let's look at what we do. You do this and I do this. They are mutually supportive. They are mutually nurturing, and therefore we are friends. Because not everybody who says the same things as you is actually good for you. And ideological community is a much weaker form of community than behavioral community. If we are behaving in a way that integrates with one another's behaviors, if we are putting our practices together into shared projects, we are really increasing our strength and therefore our freedom in the world. Not so if we just reaffirm the same statements. So the question is not for Spinoza about what's right and what's wrong for everybody everywhere. That's definitely like a universalist view that was brought by colonizers all over the world. That's about morality. Morality in this sense means a list of statements about what you should do or should not do. But ethics is a question about what practices we are already involved in and how we can swerve those practices. Morality looks for universal rules. Ethics doesn't. Maybe ethics can look for principles. Maybe there are, and then these principles have to be tested out experimentally, and we have to see if they work for us. And if they do work for us, we should hold on to them so long as they work for us, and then we should jettison them. So this is ethics, not what must we do, but what can we do? What are we capable of? So this goes back to experimentation, as with the situationists, and then to relations, right? So how do we do this? How do we think about our practices, weed them out, and by weeding through them and making selections, empower ourselves and make ourselves more free? Well, we'd never have anywhere else to carry out this kind of experimentation than right where we are. This is like Moten, right? Like Moten and Harney's idea about fugitivity. We have to become maroons, not by necessarily running to an, you know, like a faraway place, although I'm kind of down for that too, but by dropping out right where we are, by becoming potentially something different right where we are. We have to observe our practices, reflect on our practices, start to transform our practices right where we are, right? We have to learn to inhabit our situations in new ways. And specifically, we want to figure out how to inhabit those situations in such a fashion that our activity within them is less and less directed from the outside for the benefit of a system that increases inequality and decreases our capacity to change the world so that it will be better for our grandchildren, and that increases our capacity to determine our behavior locally for ourselves, to determine our situations locally for ourselves. This also means that we have to, well, all there is to do, we can only ever act where we are. This is, this is some wisdom. We can only ever act where we are. We have to start right here, and all there is where we are is the situation, and the situation is reducible to or understandable or analyzable as a set of relationships. We just got to think about our relationships. My practices are always bound up in relationships and in larger practices, right? So what I'm trying to do is to have encounters. I want to tune myself into aspects of my situation I was not tuned into before. And I want to test out those relations. I want to feel their intensity. In the indigenous language given us by like John Trudell or Deloria, I want to ask what those relationships call for. In Tikkun's language or that of the Invisible Committee or Deleuze, which is really coming very strongly here from Spinoza, I want to feel those relationships. I want to feel the intensities. And basically, if that intensity feels good, which means it is quickening, it is giving me more thoughts, it is giving me more senses of things that might be done. In Spinoza, this is joy. The joy happens when I increase my connections in a positive way, meaning in a way that I can grow. If I am connected, like I can't become more powerful, I can't become therefore more free, more capable of determining myself and determining actions without connecting. This isolated, imperial individual is the weakest, saddest creature in the world, and the rash of depression that we all go through is not an individual phenomenon, except it is a phenomenon of individuals, but it's a broad general phenomenon, which is explainable. It's not your fault. You know, like it's not just because of your serotonin, although it might manifest in your serotonin as well. It's because you're disconnected from your people. You're disconnected from your world. That's why you're depressed. And depression, the experience of sadness in Spinoza, is specifically the experience of being disconnected from anything. And if you're disconnected from everything, there is nothing upon which you can act. You cannot be free in this praxical sense, right? Not to mention in the sort of larger recognition sense, where other people see you and you see them and you are welcomed into, pulled into a community where that community is getting stronger. None of that is possible for you. Your sadness is not your fault. It's not your character. It's your situation. So we can alter that. We can alter it by seeking out new encounters. So we want to look for new people. We want to look for new places. We want to look for aspects of the places where we already are and people where we already are. And we want to feel out what else is possible in those relationships. And there are two possibilities. Some of those relationships have a pulse. They have a fire. They have an intensity. They have a potentiality. And they make me feel more alive. I need to nurture those things. I need to connect where I have been disconnected, where it is healthy for me. But then there are other ones, right? I have to be very careful. I cannot be friends with everyone. You know, as Nietzsche says, if I was friends with everyone, if I loved everyone, my love and my friendship would have no meaning whatsoever, which is the kind of generic Christian idea that I love everyone equally. Well, that means you don't love anybody. That means you don't even know what love is. Love is specific. Friendship is specific. It is only ever singular. It only ever exists in a material way as a real process through which both you and the friend, you and that which you love, are being transformed. The relationship is material. It's really happening. You can't just love everybody. And if you look around, there are many things, increasing numbers of things in your world that if you are connected to them, if you put yourself in contact with them, many things with which you are already in contact, they weaken you. They make you feel worse. They make you less capable across time. They block your thought. Those things we have to cut off. So what is it they say at the end? Friendship and freedom have sharp edges. We have to be selective. And the art, maybe you could call it part of the art of politics, is about identifying good connections and cutting off the other ones, We have to be merciless. We shouldn't just be moral. It's not just like following some set of rules about what makes a good person. Those rules always come from on high anyway. Morality is always a central aspect of a dominant ideology. The question is, what can we feel, what can we observe makes us more capable, more open, more transforming, what pushes us through a greater process of the development of our potentiality? And what is it that weakens us in these ways? What gets in our ways? There are bad relationships. There are partners that you ought to leave. There are friends who are not really your friends. There are nuclear families who only abuse you, and you should leave them, either physically or in place. To begin with, in place, right? You can withdraw your energies from those things. And, you know, as we all do, we build up defenses against these relationships which harm us. And then we can put our energy into relationships which strengthen us. It's battle. It's an aspect of war. We're not guaranteed to win. It requires strategy. You have to become willful. You have to be able to break morality. There are no universal rules. It's a project that you are encouraged not to undertake. It is heretical, and yet it's very basic, and it's very material, and it's very healthy. So we need to experiment. We need to see which encounters lead to joy and which ones lead to sorrow. We need to select for the ones that make us more joyous. Now, like one closing point or one or two here on this point, on the model of freedom that we are given, we are always told about how, well, all of our freedoms have to be limited because, you know, my freedom to swing my arms ends at your nose, right? We are going to get in one another's way. This model suggests that, like, we are only ever individuals, that who we really are is a self-contained subjectivity which has a self-interest and maybe has to be bound by some morality or whatever. But that our freedom is just being allowed to do stuff that we want, but it always has to be stopped. And so our freedoms get in the way of one another. On this model, now, there are some instances of freedom, which is the same thing as power, capacity for self-determination in the direction of the augmentation of potentiality and the capacity to produce an effect. This is Spinoza. There are some people's power, some group's power. If the KKK becomes more powerful, if their freedom, their capacity to act, to produce effects becomes broader, that's not good for us, right? That's not good for you. So there are some people's freedoms who get in the way of yours, but our being free beings is actually increased through the right connections. My freedom is not an individual phenomenon. Even before we start talking about properly political groupings and political processes, actually friendship and even my very being is already political and is already hyper-individual. My freedom grows when I find others with whom I fit. My capacity to think increases as I am connected with other people and encounter their ways of thinking. My capacity to act is increased when I meet people who I can trust and who trust me, because now we can act together and all the skills that I have are now added to the skills that my friend has and that my affinity group has, that my extended network of kin, that my solidarity network has. The more I am networked, the more I organize, the more I make myself trustworthy to the other people in these networks, all of whom are moving sort of in the same direction. Of course, there's transformation and change, and we're going to lose people, and we're going to have to lose networks as we change. None of this is like set in stone forever. But as we fit ourselves into larger collective wholes, we become more powerful. We become more free. Spinoza's model of freedom, which, you know, probably has some connection with Marx's model of freedom, is not individualistic. And that idea that we cannot be free together, or that my self-interest conflicts with your self-interest, that's nonsense, because we have all kinds of shared interests. Not us and everyone, but you and me if we're friends. You and me if we form kin. And how is this done? This is an ethical art. You have to become capable. Go back to Nietzsche. You have to become capable of making a promise and keeping a promise. You know, you have to become courageous, because then we'll be capable of confronting danger, which both we and our friends need. There are virtues that are necessary for the virtue of friendship, right? We have to transform ourselves into the kind of beings who can work in these collective networks, but we are best served if we do so. Our self-interest is really advanced even by, you know, taking steps that look self-sacrificing in different respects, because insofar as I've got that network, I've got more capacity. People care about me. People will sustain me. People will feed me. People will love me. People will recognize me. My freedom cannot be individual. It must be collective. My interest cannot simply be individual. It must also be collective. But this does not mean that I am just a part of a universal mass, undifferentiated, where I'm friends with everybody, I love everybody, and they all recognize me. That doesn't exist. It can't exist. And we should be careful about believing that it exists. Okay, so lastly, what should we do? As in Tikkun, we should make friends and we should identify enemies. We should commit to those friends. We should seek to transform ourselves and them in place. This is also still Aristotle. We want to develop our capacities and we want to grow our web of power. We should open up our families. Don't just get stuck in your couple, what the individual, invisible committee called autism for two, right? Like, they want to convince you that if you just find the love of your life, it's going to be all like unicorns and ponies and rainbows and, you know, Netflix and popcorn till you die. And that's the best that you can hope for. They would really like to take all of your desire, all of your urge for happiness, for the development of your potentiality, and to lock it up in one other person's face. Right? You can just sit and stare at that face until you die. Please don't do that. You will weaken. There might be a period during which staring into this other person's face is the most liberating and empowering and transformative and frightening thing that you can go through. You should do it there. But the idea that you could lock yourself into a monogamous relationship and be stuck there is one of the traps that they set for us, so that we will die without ever becoming free, so that we will die without ever building the kind of social networks and real ethical fabric that can really exist this machinery of exploitation. We should open up our families. You know, the dream of the white picket fence and the closed home with mommy, daddy, me, and maybe another sibling or whatever, that needs to be broken. It's not that they're all bad. There are good families, right? But the better they are, I bet the more extended they are too. And ideally, we should extend the care and the commitment and the mutual self-defense. These are all features, explicit features of like medieval communes. This is the way that they would define the communards, or the ones who had pledged to mutual self-defense. We should extend those relationships, not to everybody, which would be meaningless, but beyond the nuclear family to those who are good for us. And in order to do that, in order to find the people who are good to us, for us, we have to risk. We have to risk opening ourselves up in order to really feel, to be recognized or not, to be nurtured or not, to be cared for or not, to be stimulated, caused to think or not by other beings, right? This means we're going to get hurt. We can't be free without getting hurt. But you can develop an art of feeling these things out before you get hurt too bad, right? And so at the same time that we have to open ourselves, if we want any hope of being free, of being powerful, and also of transforming society in such a fashion that it's not all dead in 100 years, we have to open ourselves up and be vulnerable. But we also have to develop the art of shutting ourselves off and shutting down toxic relationships, of not allowing ourselves to be taken into relationships which weaken us, not to be taken into patriarchal relationships, not to be taken into abusive relationships, right? We have to cut off certain things. We have to be surgical. So the overall goal is really to recover, to, you know, facilitate the resurgence of, but in a new context, forms of life, ways of life. We want to reintegrate the ethical social fabric so that society continue, like shows up again, but not the old society, which can't exist in a new situation because a society is nothing but a set of relationships within a situation and to a situation. Rather, we want to build new integrities, new connections between what we do and how we live and how we think and who we are, where we are involved with the very processes that are producing ourselves, that are producing the society. And that is the means by which we can build the social strength, the tensile strength almost, the infrastructural integrity across a collective that could begin to and surely must resist these extractive, exploitative, profit-oriented machines. And lastly, each one of these gestures about forming connections, testing connections, showing mutual respect, cutting off bad connections, seeking to build networks of solidarity, all of these things, we need to repeat them and refine them across time. We need to build new habits in these directions.